Would you believe it? Me again, already so soon. It's the Scott Horton Show. I'm here on the Liberty Radio Network. Weekdays from noon to 2, libertyradionetwork.com, LRN.FM. I think they should just change it to libertyradionetwork.com. Short URLs are out. And nobody's ever heard of .FM. They don't know what that means. LibertyRadioNetwork.com. It forwards right on there. And then see, when you say it that way, it says right exactly what it is in the title. Liberty Radio Network. Where everybody's a libertarian. Mm-hmm. All right, so yeah, I'm Scott Horton, and my part in this is I do the anti-war show. I mean, everybody on here is anti-war, but that's all the hell I ever complain about, other than the murder of cops and sometimes paper money. Hate paper money. Hate it. But mostly I hate the wars that it pays for and the cops that it pays for. Mostly the wars. And so, yeah, foreign policy, that's the thing. Today we'll have Robert Naiman on. Oh, man, I didn't even write up a blog entry. I was sitting here waiting for more people to answer me back. I invited Michael Clare from Tom Dispatch, has a good one about Russia and China and all this kind of crap. And I invited a bunch of people. I'd have to go look at my sent folder. But so far I got Robert Naiman. Oh, I invited Phil Giraldi too. He's got a good new Iran piece. Today's show, Robert. Whoops. I'm a really bad typist. Oh man, come on. I'm not this bad. Yeah, Robert Naiman, he's good. He's from Just Foreign Policy. He's against it, too. He's a liberal, not a libertarian, but that's all right. He's against it. And he's really good on Palestine, and we got, Gaza flotilla attempted aid relief news to cover with him, so he's going to be on the show in just a while. And then we'll see whether I can get anybody else lined up. Tomorrow on the show, Stephen Walt. Oh, good. Giraldi's going to be here at 1. 1 Eastern. Great. Okay, today's show. Oops. Stephen Walt is going to be here tomorrow. I want to talk with him about the Islamic State. He has an interesting thing that he wrote about the Islamic State recently I want to talk to him about. And then on Friday, Dr. Ron Paul is going to be here. Ooh, but it's a surprise what we're going to talk about. Do you want to know the surprise? Should I tell you? Well, I ain't gonna. It's a secret. Ron Paul will be on the show on Friday. So that should be fun. And you know, all that assumes that the show will even last till Friday because, you know, fun drive ain't going too well. Oh, you freeloading libertarians, man. You got to give up some of what you got to keep this thing that you love so much going on. Pretty much simple as that. If you value the show, well, then trade what you think equal value. I'll take bitcoins. You can do single donations. You can do monthly donations. You can donate per interview at patreon.com. You can go buy it that way, patreon.com/Scott Horton Show. Anybody who donates $50 gets a raffle ticket to win a trip to Costa Rica, for crying out loud. And anybody who donates $100 or more, you get a raffle ticket for the contest to win a trip to Costa Rica. And also you get a 1 ounce QR code commodity disc. And you get either Sheldon Richman's book, Your Money or Your Life Against the Income Tax, or the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me. So that's for anybody who donates $100 or more. It's fun drive time here at the Scott Horton Show. And yeah, well, you know, everything costs money. And you know what? I shouldn't be so shy about all this. All these liberals and conservatives, man, they'll take your money all day for a bunch of crap. I'm just trying to debunk the worst things going on in the world, the reasons why, the supposed reasons why the worst thing is wrong in the world. And literally, not figuratively, literally the wheels are coming off in the studio. I'm talking about the chair that I'm sitting in. It is, yeah, I need money for replacing things like this beat old microphone that never goes quieter than negative 63. That's down to negative 66. Yeah, that's pretty good. Well, still, never goes lower than that. And the wheels are literally coming off of the damn chair. So, I think that's a good enough reason to hold a fundraising thing. It used to be that you donate all your money to antiwar.com and I would get some of it. Now, not so much. Now you got to give some to them and some to me. I know, it's really tough. Yeah, check it out. Y'all want to win a free vacation to the jungles of Costa Rica this summer and help support the Scott Horton Show? You can. Joshua Hughes, peace activist and permaculturalist, runs Verde Energia Pacifica, an intentional community in the mountains of Llanos de Puriscal, Costa Rica, and he's offered to raffle off a week's stay to listeners of this show. Airfare is on you, but transportation to and from the airport, as well as a 7-day stay for you and a guest in your own private house with 3 meals a day, is covered. You can learn and practice some skills, or just go for a swim in their river, pool, or waterfall, walk jungle trails, enjoy the views, do yoga or dance in the studio, make art, play music, check out a local soccer game, or simply relax in a hammock by the river and read. Raffle tickets are just $50. Stop by scotthorton.org/raffle for details. And anyone who enters will get half off on any future stay down there. scotthorton.org/raffle. All right, now, good. Just a couple minutes left to talk about this. I saw one this morning. You know, come to think of it, it might even be a somewhat old article. Let me click on this thing and see if it's even brand new or not. What's the date on this goddamn thing? You know, Medium, it looks nice, but where's all the information I'm looking for here, man? Like, when this was published. You know, it could have the date in the URL or something. I don't know. God dang it, Bobby. Oh, wait, maybe it says, oh, it says down at the bottom, if you, in a little pop-up bar, if you scroll down there, or, you know, mouse point down there, June 29th, brand new. So check it out, and the article is, David Axe at War is Boring. He got a hold of the papers, he got a hold of the after-action reports, and wrote this: test pilot admits the F-35 can't dogfight. Now, we already knew this. We already knew that the F-35 was the world's worst piece of crap. But here is the thing. He's got the paperwork about how an F-16 designed by rogue Lockheed engineers in the 1970s, who were defying their executives' will and making a plane that was simple and worked well and, you know, was cheap. Relatively, you know, the F-16 from the 1970s kills the F-35 every time. They had them dogfight. We presume equal skill level of the pilots. F-16 kills the F-35 every time. They figured out in all of these contests, they figured out one way to basically stop flying and just kick the yaw so hard that it's sliding, basically, rather than using its airfoils, just sliding sideways and figuring out a way to squeeze off, line up one missile shot out of every different angle of attack that they practiced. They found one way that they could get off a successful shot, but then in doing so, they lose all their speed and momentum and whatever, and have to correct and end up getting shot down a moment later anyway. And it only works once. It would only work once. Anyway, you got to read this thing and understand, as according to the engineer, the Lockheed engineer who designed the F-16 and F-15, which they also say BC F-35, the F-35 does work. I mean 15. It does work because its purpose is to take your money. That's it. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code SCOTT when you sign up, And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. Hey, y'all, guess what? You can now order transcripts of any interview I've done for the incredibly reasonable price of $2.50 each. Listen, finding a good transcriptionist is near impossible, but I've got one now. Just go to scotthorton.org/transcripts, enter the name and date of the interview you want written up, click the PayPal button, and I'll have it in your email in 72 hours max. You don't need a PayPal account to do this. Man, I'm really going to have to learn how to talk more good. That's scotthorton.org/transcripts. All right, I really wonder. I don't really wonder, but I kind of wonder. Is it me? Am I just almost 39 and just not funny and just so cynical and jaded and over it at this point that hilarious Onion productions just don't make me laugh? Or is it that the Onion sucks? Japanese guys saw a little fish eat a whale. This just in. I just don't see the humor in that. I'm picturing the board meeting where they came up with that one. Oh yeah, that one's a real good one, Johnny. Run with that. Write it up and make Bill read it into the microphone. Really? Giant food chain shakeup. I barely wonder if it's me. I'm pretty sure the Onion just isn't funny. Okay, guys, it's summer fun drive time at the Scott Horton Show. Bills are piling up and equipment is wearing out. So here's the deal. Anyone who donates $50 or more gets a chance to win a week's vacation for two to Costa Rica. Drawing is July 15th. Winner, go whenever you want. See more details at scotthorton.org/raffle. Anyone who donates $100 or more gets entered into the raffle, plus a 1-ounce silver QR code commodity disc from commoditydiscs.com. And the first 25 people to donate $100 or more will also get a copy of Your Money or Your Life, Why We Must Abolish the Income Tax by Sheldon Richman, or the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism versus Capitalism, narrated by me, for free. Stop by scotthorton.org/donate or scotthorton.org/raffle for details. You can also sign up for monthly donations by way of PayPal, per interview at Patreon, support with Bitcoin, and shop through scotthorton.org/Amazon. And thanks. All right, cool. Yeah, more bad news. Coming up, Phil Giraldi, Robert Naiman. Better write that down so I don't forget what the hell I'm doing here. Let's see, F-35. Oh, Israel. Let's talk about Iran for a second. Oh, no, that's going to be for the Phil Giraldi interview there. Let's go ahead and do the Israel stuff. Israeli troops capture Gaza aid ship. This will be going over with Robert Naiman. But I wanted to point out a couple from MondoWeiss.net. Sniper shots and mass arrests. UN Gaza report also documents Israeli abuses in the West Bank last summer. And you know what? I actually meant to email Alex Kane about this. I completely spaced it out. I was going to ask him to come on the show about it. I just didn't have time to read the whole thing, I guess, was why I didn't send him the invite. Maybe tomorrow or the next day. But it's, you know, basically calling attention to the lead-up to the canned hunt assault on the children of the Gaza Strip last year. The pretext for war was the kidnapping of these three young Israelis and teenagers. And the thing of it was that they were killed immediately. And the Israeli government knew that. But they lied. And they pretended to the 6 or 7 million, or I don't know how many Israeli citizens there are, Jewish and otherwise, but they pretended to the population of their country for 2 full weeks, and actually a little bit more than that, I think, that the three boys were alive, and that they knew they were alive, and that they were, one, searching for them, and two, negotiating with the bad guys over releasing them. Maybe they're just searching for them, supposedly. That's been a year. And anyway, so what they did was, this was all, they exploited this because the PLA and Hamas had recently come back together again, or for the first time, I guess, created a real coalition government. And it was Hamas signing on to the PLA's agenda, not the other way around. And divide and conquer, that's the policy. And so what they did was they targeted every Hamas official or even supposed, Hamas official or employee or anything else on the West Bank. They went house to house all over the place, rousting people. I wish I had a good footnote right off the top of my head, but I'm certain you can find this probably at Mondo Weiss. In fact, I think Max Blumenthal wrote this up at Electronic Intifada back a year ago. And that was about, and in his story about how the Israeli government pretended for 2 weeks to believe that the boys were still alive, and that they were searching for him and all that. And he has the documented evidence that they were launching missile strikes into the Gaza Strip in the name of blaming Hamas for what had happened to the boys when it wasn't Hamas that did it. And that all preceded the rocket fire. And then, of course, once a single Roman candle comes over the wall, a single bottle rocket, they go, "Oh, my God, look, the Hamas terrorists are attacking us." You know, like if I slapped you in the face 100 times and then you punched me. Or actually, the other way around. If I punched you in the face over and over again and then you finally slapped me back. And then I went, "Oh, man, look, it's aggression." That's the Israeli way. Yeah, they're very dishonest in their all of their government policies. Then again, I guess that's the same thing for all governments, but this one particularly pisses me off because it's with my money and it engenders terrorist attacks against American civilians, of which I'm one, so, you know, and other people I know, too. So there's that. MondoWeiss.net, a little bit of a write-up in the UN report about what happened in the West Bank and not just the Gaza Strip, and I don't know if the UN report really goes into the timeline. Oh, it does say the UN documents how Israel arrests and detains hundreds of children and, you know, how they basically provoked the attack for weeks, provoked the bottle rocket before the first bottle rocket. And then this other thing I think is really important, too. It's called My Journey from Zionism to Palestine Solidarity. And it's by Adam Horowitz, not the Beastie Boy, but the Mondo Weiss writer. And what he says is he grew up in a conservative Jewish Zionist household in where, New Jersey or Pennsylvania or something? Outside Philadelphia. And he just grew up and learned basic facts. I mean, if you read this essay, what he says is the first time that he was exposed to the other side of the story about the Palestinians, and the first time especially that he went to the West Bank and saw what the occupation was like, as he says here, the visceral hate the settlers and Israeli military hold for the Palestinians whose city they have taken. He said, oh, well, look. I should have highlighted all the best quotes in here, but he basically says, well, look, I come from American Jewish values, which are basically liberal ones. I'm a civil rights guy, he says, and that could be very little liberal, although I think he's probably not. I think he's probably much more of a just regular capital L liberal, but still. Equal rights and Zionism are opposites, so which do you choose? It's a very simple thing here, man. He makes it very, very simple and clear, and it's a good read for people who are caught up in this crap, I bet, too.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support the Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. Here in a little while, Phil Giraldi, and then Robert Naiman. All right. All right, enough of that crap. The Turk and the Islamic State thing, and the, I guess let's talk about the torture. Let's talk about the torture. New evidence on CIA medical torture. Injection to the bone. On former black site prisoner Majid Khan. This is by our friend Jeff K. over at FireDogLake.com. Quite recently, U.S. authorities allowed the declassification of notes from Center for Constitutional Rights attorney Wells Dixon that described what his client, high-value detainee Majid Khan, told him about his torture at the hands of the CIA. Khan, a Pakistan citizen, is currently in Guantanamo and awaits trial by military commission. Dixon has described the hideous torture of his client, which comes on the heels of revelations in the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence executive summary of their report on the CIA's torture program. According to a June 2nd Reuters report, Dixon described from interview notes with Khan CIA use of solitary confinement, sexual abuse, including frequent touching of private parts, threats of physical harm, being hung naked from a pole for days, so-called rectal feeding, a form of anal rape, denial of food, water immersion, and waterboarding, among other atrocities. According to a CCR press release on Khan's torture, CIA doctors on site were among the, quote, worst torturers. Both Reuters and CCR have noted how doctors would check Khan's condition, ignore his appeals for help, and send him back into extreme forms of torture. In a June 2nd phone... Pardon me. I don't know how the hell I did that. In a June 10th phone interview with Wells Dixon, Khan's attorney revealed there was more unreported material left out of the Reuters and CCR reports. In particular, Dixon revealed that Khan told him he was, quote, also injected with a needle to the bone and screamed in pain, then lost consciousness. Again, Jeffrey K. According to my research, an injection that just happens to hit a bone does not usually cause great pain, but an injection that enters the bone can. The latter is called an intraosseous or IO injection and is used to quickly infuse drugs, particularly in instances where a person's life is at stake. It is usual medical procedure to insert lidocaine, a pain reliever, lidocaine, a pain reliever, with or prior to injection because of the great pain associated with IO injections. Certain kinds of drugs can also cause great pain upon injection. Did the CIA have a medical need to make an IO injection and withhold lidocaine or other pain reliever? Did CIA use the IO injections specifically to cause pain? Was a drug injected into Khan that specifically or as a side effect caused great pain in order to further torture him? We don't know exactly what the CIA did with this or any other injection. Well, I don't know about that. But the evidence of such forms of medical torture cannot be denied. Despite recent attempts by the CIA to minimize allegations of such medical torture, such as the use of drugs in interrogation. In fact, a recent FOIA release from CIA obtained by Jason Leopold at Vice News showed that the CIA used blood thinners to prolong certain forms of torture. It has not been easy to obtain this information. As Dixon noted in a June 22nd op-ed at Al Jazeera, quote, the CIA has long tried to bury evidence of its crimes. When we filed a legal case challenging Majid's detention after his arrival at Guantanamo, the government prevented us from meeting with him for a year or so that we would not learn about his torture. A new article by Adam Goldman at the Washington Post revealed that hundreds of photos from a CIA black site exist. The CIA black site. Oh, so these guys... Did we miss a paragraph here? What the hell happened? Or was he one of these two? No. I think Kay messed up and left out a detail, unless I'm reading it wrong. He's referring to this story by Adam Goldman in the Washington Post. CIA photos of black sites could complicate Guantanamo trials. And it's about, get this. You know what? No, I'm the one screwing up and conflating two different things, because there was this other report from the Washington Post. Hey, at least it was the Washington Post. They're both from the same paper, is why I got confused, is my excuse. Two Tunisians interrogated at CIA black site in Afghanistan secretly flown home. And see, I conflated those things together, that the pictures were of the black site in Afghanistan. But that's my mistake. This is a separate story about, and it's also by Adam Goldman, and it's about a CIA black site, a CIA black site, that has been kept open this entire time in Afghanistan. Not a military black site, a CIA one, even though officially they closed them all back in 2006 and brought all the high-value CIA detainees to Guantanamo, which is the guy, like, for example, the guy we're talking about right now on the other tab there. So that's another huge story. Anyway, sorry. Back to Jeffrey Kay there. At, again, FireDogLake.com. UN Special Reporter's Letter of Allegation to U.S. on Medical Torture and Experimentation. A new article by Adam Goldman at the Washington Post revealed that hundreds of photos from the CIA black sites exist. Oh, like all of them? Wow. See, I should have read that thing. The fact that they may be evidence at any future military commission's trial is currently being determined. As military prosecutors review the photos, which are said to include pictures of naked detainees, CIA personnel, and photographs of confinement boxes where detainees such as Abu Zubaydah were forced into for hours. It is highly unlikely the public will see these photos, and we will have to rely on detainee testimony and other various attempts by journalists, domestic and international bodies and organizations to pry out the information from the U.S. government. Along those lines, the Center for Constitutional Rights has called for the full Senate CIA torture report and the Panetta review. That's the internal CIA report that you remember was of such controversy, because it said that all the accusations were actually true and all the denials were lies. And it was an internal CIA report that they panicked when they found out that the Senate, committee staffers got their hands on it, even though they had probably, most likely, accidentally turned it over to them themselves. And at that point, the CIA ran a covert operation against the United States Senate. Remember that? Oh, yeah, no, this is a limited temporary constitutional republic you're living in here, right? Not the most corrupt and murderous empire in, well, at least in modern times, in our times. And the CIA ran a whole op against the Senate to try to prevent that report from coming out. So, yeah, if anything, forget the 6,300-page Senate report, or go ahead and release it. But that's what I want to see, is the Panetta review, the internal CIA report that we already know what it says, that that all the accusations are true and all their lies are lies. Makes you wonder why Panetta even ordered the review at all. Why would he want to know something like that? A letter initiated by ACLU and signed by approximately 100 national and international rights groups on the need to ensure accountability for the U.S. CIA torture program was delivered to the most recent session of the UN Human Rights Council. Scroll that. I don't know about that. It's our responsibility to see every single one of these guys, from George Bush, his entire national security cabinet, their lawyers, and all of their agents and contractors who participated in this.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com.
Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at DarrensCoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. DarrensCoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. DarrensCoffee.com. All right, so yeah, man, looks like Rodriguez really screwed up. I was reading that article during the break here, the one I should have read before. 14,000 photos of the black sites. They destroyed the videos of the interrogations. But 14,000 photos of the salt pit, torture dungeon outside of Kabul. That's kind of, you gotta admit, it's poetic, isn't it? America and their salt pit torture dungeon. Yeah, that's how we do business. Yeah, we're a limited temporary constitutional republic. Well, that's our form of government here. Constitutional republic. And check out our salt pit torture dungeon where we torture people to death. So much fun. You know, for some of us. All right. Here's some good news. Florida man accused of terrorism based on book collection set free. Well, geez, according to my book collection, I'm a Muslim, a commie, a Nazi, and a libertarian. How do you like that? Oh, and I guess a historian. Would you buy that? I'm a historian, Your Honor. Geez, I just like reading about things. All right. The U.S. government had produced snippets of information from various sources out of context to weave together a narrative of terrorist ideation. A Florida judge said Friday, you realize how criminal your prosecutor's gotta be to get your judge to talk like that? Well, basically, the prosecutors put together a bogus conspiracy theory based on a bunch of crap. Hey, we're just asking questions, the prosecutor said. Based on a bunch of ridiculous false premises. Robertson, also known as Abu Taba. Tauba? Oh, and by the way, this is from Murtaza Hussein, who I just interviewed on the show yesterday about the other fake torture case, the Fort Dix pizza plot. Amazing story there. On, Chris Christie's big day. That's out there floating around about how Chris Christie prosecuted these wholly innocent men. But anyway, so check this out. This guy has been incarcerated since 2011 on charges of tax fraud and illegal gun possession. Yeah, you liberals just love gun laws. Did he hurt anybody with a gun? Nope. He possessed one. And either didn't pay the right tax or, in what other way? He didn't wait 48 hours to get his license or something. After his arrest and subsequent conviction on those charges, prosecutors sought to add a terrorism enhancement to his sentence. A sentencing guideline modification that would have sent the Islamic scholar to prison for up to 20 years. Instead, following the judge's rejection of the enhancement, he was sentenced to time served and ordered released immediately. Huh. Robertson's case attracted national attention after prosecutors attempted to argue earlier this year that the contents of his book collection constituted evidence of his connection to terrorism. Prosecutors singled out roughly 20 titles from the more than 10,000 e-books Robertson owned, highlighted a selection of controversial passages and used that to argue that he should be sentenced as though he were a terrorist. You've got to be kidding. I mean, hey, close enough for government work, right? Give him the needle. None of Robertson's charges, conspiracy to file a false tax return, and possession of a firearm by a convicted felon, were terrorism offenses. In a memorandum issued along with his decision yesterday, Judge Gregory A. Presnell strongly repudiated the government's argument that Robertson's book collection proved a connection to terrorism. Quote, "There was no evidence produced that Robertson ever accessed these particular documents, much less that he took their extremism to heart," Presnell wrote, noting that even had Robertson read the books in question, it would not have constituted evidence of terrorism, or anything else, other than literacy, which ain't outlawed yet, or anymore in the case of black people. The government has never disputed Robertson's claim of being an Islamic scholar, the judge continued. It is not at all remarkable for an Islamic scholar to study, among many, many others, the writings of Islamic extremists. The memorandum concluded by describing the sum of the government's terrorism allegations against Robertson woefully inadequate, adding that the government had not even come close to proving his relatively minor income tax fraud was intended to promote a federal crime of terrorism. Anyway, so good for this one judge. Don't let it fool you into thinking there's a real separation of powers here in America. It's the state versus you, and they're all in it together. In this one case, this judge has certainly done the right thing. But what does this tell you about the prosecutors? They are not honest. They're not seeking justice. They are criminals. They are attempting to conspire with the court to put 20 years of kidnapped cage time on a man who they know is not a terrorist and didn't participate in terrorist anything. And if they could have gotten the judge to go along with it, then they would be criminals together, right? In this case, this was so exceptionally thin, this argument, that he had, you know, whoever's book on his shelf. It didn't work. But how many people are nailed with this? And imagine that too. You get convicted of some measly crime, something that they could actually try to pin on anyone that they want to target and go fishing on. And then after you're convicted of that, then they say, by the way, Your Honor, he's a terrorist. So you should enhance his sentence as though we just convicted him of terrorism, even though they haven't. It's a temporary limited constitutional republic here. Oh, yeah, and the Fifth Amendment is the rule of law and a bunch of mythology like that. A sentencing enhancement for a crime not proven. Possessing a firearm. Conspiring to submit a fraudulent tax return. Wow, I don't know about that, man. What does that mean? He asked someone else to help him do it? Was it H&R Block or what? You know, it's just like Sheldon Richmond says, too. In Your Money or Your Life, I'm sure he says this in there somewhere. It's all about control. The IRS, you know, they can print their money all day long. They'll boom and bust us. They don't give a damn. They don't need the IRS to tax the American people. It just gives them an excuse. It's a big, fake, probable cause for the government to intervene in your affairs, to keep you in line, to keep you in fear. Oh, they got him on what? On evading taxes and possessing a firearm. Very liberal and progressive causes, both. And then they tried to nail him with a right-wing terrorism enhancement, which for all I know was Bill Clinton's, you know, law from back in 96 or whatever, but anyway. God dang point being that the American system is completely and totally corrupt. They don't love you. They don't care for you. And they just as soon completely destroy you and not care at all. Hey, that's the job. Once you get the job as the prosecutor, then yes, of course you're destroying the lives of people who don't deserve it. But hey, you made that decision when you decided to become a prosecutor. So now that that decision has been made, you don't have to worry about that ever again. That's what we do here. We see just how much we can get away with. And then, hey, it's an adversarial system. I hope your lawyer is friends with the judge, because otherwise we're going to nail you. And then, after you're convicted, we're going to ask the judge to sentence you for a crime that we didn't convict you of. That's the American system. That's why we take off our baseball hats and cry when they sing their little anthem to state power at the ball game. Yeah, we're so free and brave. I mean, except for the 2.5 million people in prison right now. Convicted of God knows what offense against state power. Violating whatever prohibition. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. Phone records, financial and location data, Prism, Tempora, X-Keyscore, Boundless Informant. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for offnow.org. Now, here's the deal. Due to the Snowden revelations, we have a great opportunity for a short period of time to get some real rollback of the national surveillance state. Now, they're already trying to tire us by introducing fake reforms in the Congress. And the courts, they betray their sworn oaths to the Constitution and Bill of Rights again and again, and can in no way be trusted to stop the abuses for us. We've got to do it ourselves. How? We nullify it at the state level. It's still not easy, but the OffNow project of the 10th Amendment Center has gotten off to a great start. I mean it. There's real reason to be optimistic here. They've gotten their model legislation introduced all over the place, in state after state. I've lost count, more than a dozen. You're always wondering, yeah, but what can we do? Here's something. Something important. Something that can work if we do the work. Get started cutting off the NSA support in your state. Go to offnow.org. All right, guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Live from noon to 2 Eastern time here on the Liberty Radio Network on the weekdays. Archives at scotthorton.org. First interview today is our friend Phil Giraldi from the Council for the National Interest. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org. Former CIA and DIA officer and writer for UNS.com and the American Conservative Magazine. And here he is at the UNS Review, that's UNZ, UNS.com. Crunch time with Iran. Let's push back against Israel's friends and avoid a war. Well, that sounds pretty good. Welcome back to the show. How you doing, Phil?
I'm fine, Scott. How about you?
I'm doing good. Appreciate you writing this and coming on the show. So, you know, I just don't have the stomach to read Jennifer Rubin. I'm glad that you do. and she certainly is a great example and probably a great place to start this discussion. You write here... well, and we can get to the talks, too, but let's start with the propaganda push. You really document thoroughly here a very deep, well-funded, it sounds like, and maybe foreign push on the Internet and all over the place and, of course, in the neoconservative movement to scotch this Iran deal. They're really doing everything that they possibly can to build up, opposition among whatever public or whatever interest groups that they possibly can get to.
Yeah, basically, yeah. The point of the article is that, the outline for an agreement between the United States and the other five countries involved in negotiations in Iran have been there for like 2 years. I mean, everybody knows what it is. It's Iran basically wants to be normalized and wants release from the sanctions. And the United States, for its part, wants Iran to have no course to obtain a nuclear weapon, and that basically should be verifiable. It's as simple as that. Now, people are arguing now all kinds of things and saying, oh, well, but what about Iran's support of terrorism? What about the fact that Iran is destabilizing the Middle East? And which is a funny thing coming from Americans. But, you know, these kinds of arguments are being made because they don't really have a good argument. And the whole intention here is to make sure that this agreement does not go through because Israel and its friends don't want it. So the thing is that if you look at what's been happening over particularly over the last month as this deadline has been approaching, there's just been an avalanche of negative information in the media and among politicians essentially saying, that, oh, this is a bad deal. And it's not a bad deal. It's a good deal for everybody, including Israel.
Yeah, see, that's the thing of it. And I'm sorry, audience, because I know I'm just such a broken record. I'm always quoting Stephen Walt about this, where he talks about how those of us who aren't afraid of Iran or their civilian safeguarded nuclear electricity program are the ones who want this deal really bad. And all the people who pretend to be terrified of those insane and unnegotiable 12th Imamists getting their hands on the H-bombs that'll kill us all in our jammies in the middle of the night, they don't want a deal. They don't want to expand the inspections regime beyond all reason or precedent in the history of the NPT or any of this kind of stuff. They're determined to have a war under the excuse of a nuclear program that is, like we're already talking about, not a nuclear weapons program at all and never was.
Yeah. I mean, and the thing is, you know, when you consider what's going on, there's only one possible conclusion to come through, and that's essentially that Israel, acting against its own short-term interests, believes its longer-term interest is essentially to create a situation where the United States will attack and take out Iran. And that's essentially what these guys want. They want a war. They figure, I think in a crazy way, that such a war would be containable, that it would be short, that it would be decisive. But, you know, the history certainly of the last 15 years has taught us that ain't the case.
Yeah. Well, hey, let me ask you about the Saudi position on this for a minute, because, of course, there's a new king, and I don't know how much different that makes or exactly what amount of control America has over the Saudi kingdom when it comes to these kinds of things. Officially, they've said, hey, yeah, we're for a deal. Hey, you Americans, you're our friends. You know what you're doing, so we trust you. But then apparently, no, they really don't mean that. They're really pissed off about it. But the facts of the case, I mean, because they're not neocon liars. I mean, maybe they have their agenda and their point of view or whatever, but they understand the simple truth that what we're talking about is a civilian program that is now going to be way scaled back and inspected further than ever before, safeguarded further than ever before, with less likelihood than ever before that it's actually going to be put to a nuclear weapon. So maybe, you know, they're afraid of rapprochement between America and Iran once this nuclear issue is out of the way, but are they that upset, really?
I think you hit the nail on the head. What they're not afraid of Iran as a nuclear power. What they are afraid of is the rapprochement. And they're also afraid of a normalized Iran, because Iran is by the relative to the region is a major power, and it has an industrial base, it has natural resources, it has a highly educated and creative population. So the Saudis are more concerned about a challenge in their neighborhood from a regime that they dislike for religious reasons more than anything else. And that's their concern. I mean, I think this, the nuclear issue has been kind of a phony issue for a long time.
Yeah.
And I think that the nuclear issue kind of is a convenient shorthand way of saying, we don't trust these guys, we don't want these guys, but really it masks a lot of other issues that these various constituencies in the Middle East, are really concerned with.
Well, and I guess this nuclear deal really does amount to a real turning point, a real change in America's policy of keeping Iran down and contained that we've had since 79. And I know Bush got rid of Saddam for them in 2003 and fought a whole war for their guys, but that was an accident mostly because they're stupid. and listen to Ahmed Chalabi and that kind of thing. But so, you know, that's not really an aberration in the policy as much as just, you know, kind of a mistake. But the policy has stayed the same. And do you think that this, if they get this nuclear deal, and especially, I guess, considering that we have a new president coming in, a pretty predictable one, probably, I think. Do you think that this even could amount to a real change in America's policy toward the, you know, Mullah's regime or whatever the hell it's called?
Well, you know, a lot depends on how the other situation, which is the situation in Iraq and Syria, plays out. Because Iran is a major asset for the United States in terms of a counterweight to ISIS. And it's also a major counterweight in terms of creating a stable situation in terms of Iraq and Syria, which are friendly to Iran and in a sense are almost client states. So there are a lot of U.S. interests that actually merge with Iranian interests, and I would not be surprised if we had a president who wasn't tied hand and foot by various interests to see the light on that. I think back a few months ago was even, you know, there were even rumors going around that the United States was thinking of working together with Iran, and in fact there were some indications that they were doing just that. So I think there was a definite community of interest. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, never mind principled libertarianism or non-intervention or anything, but just there, you know, from the accepting the argument of the empire itself and its existence, there's still a lot of damn daylight here, Phil, between the American and the Israeli interest in the Middle East, where, as you say, in what makes sense at all from the American side, if we have to be in, again, accepting all these premises of intervention, we're on the Shiite side, or they're on our side, and here we are allied with all the Sunnis who are our enemies and backing our enemies.
Yeah, that's the irony of it, isn't it? I mean, it's it common sense would tell you. In fact, I have a piece that will be appearing later this week at the American Conservative on the new State Department report on terrorism, on international terrorism, mm-hmm. which covers the year 2014. And I make the comment, I said, there's something wrong here because the report is claiming that ISIS is the major emerging terrorist threat for the whole world. And yet we are doing everything we can to oppose the countries that are frontline states opposing ISIS, which would be Iran and Syria. And so, you know, the whole policy is screwed up.
Yep. All right. Hold it right there. It's Phil Giralli, everybody. He's at the Council for the National Interest and at UNS.com. We'll be right back. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our status enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism Versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. So I'm talking to Phil Giralli, and as usual, the discussion has gone way off course to the fact that America and its allies are backing our enemies in the war in Syria. And by the way, Phil, I have to just work this in here. I had totally missed this. This is at the Council on Foreign Relations journal, Foreign Affairs, from their March issue, accepting al-Qaeda. The enemy of the United States enemy. And, of course, Assad is our enemy because Israel says so. And I guess because Turkey says so and Saudi says so. But anyway, I mean, I know that we all know and we've covered on the show there's been this attempt to rehabilitate al-Qaeda in Syria as the moderate ISIS since the mythical moderates have, you know, whatever did exist of them is basically gone now. So now the al-Qaeda guys in this Syria war are the moderates, and they're working really hard. They're working really hard at it when they're going to make this a headline in Foreign Affairs, where, you know, it's the same story with them all the time, backing monsters and then recommending the backing of monsters and then recommending wars against them and then recommending the backing of those same monsters again and over for the last century almost now. But anyway, so that's all to say that's the tangent we got off on, and maybe we can get back to that because I actually have some more questions to ask about that. But really, I want to talk about this article and what's in it because it's really important. We're right at the deadline. They've extended the deadline for a few more days, but we're trying to get this Iran nuclear deal through. You've got the entire lobby and all of their allies literally, as you document in here, doing everything they possibly can, including spamming the comment sections all over the internet and every other thing they can possibly do to scotch this thing. And then on the other side, you have the president, who seems to have staked a lot on this, and he sure seems to have the attitude that he wants to see this through. Do you think they can stop him?
Yeah, I think they can stop him. I think that what we've seen certainly over the last couple of weeks shows that there's actually an intensity of activity attacking the line now is, of course, that we want a deal. Everybody's saying, yeah, we want a deal, but we want a good deal. And essentially that is a lie because they don't want a good deal. They want no deal. And they can stop them. It depends on whether Obama feels confident that he has enough support within his own party. That's the key to this, to avoid having this defeated in Congress after he agrees to it. So I think that's what it comes down to. He's counting the numbers, and I think if he probably will not go through with it if he thinks he's going to be, if he's fairly confident he'll be defeated in Congress. So yeah, they can do it. But I'm mildly optimistic. I think Obama will stick by his guns, and I think he realizes that this is the right thing to do. And I think we will see this. That doesn't mean the struggle will stop then, but it'll enter a different phase. But hopefully we'll see this get done within a week.
Yeah, man. Well, and you know, once they have it done, then the politics really should shift in his favor strongly, where now I got this deal, I've determined it's in our national interest, and I'm our commander-in-chief and all that nonsense, and so are you really going to screw this up? That's a different frame of events from than, you know, the way it is now. So I sure hope. I mean, I'm mildly optimistic, too. I, you know, seems like he told Kerry, yeah, let's do this thing. And, you know, as you reported back, a year or 2 years ago now, I forget, that they already worked, I think a year ago, they already worked all the details here out in, no, it was 2 years ago, right, before the fall of 2013 deal. They already worked out all the details in their secret talks in Amman, according to your sources.
Yeah, that's right. They basically, the details of this have been worked out for a long time. What's going on now is it's kind of the fine tuning, where everybody thought they had a basic understanding of what's going on. But the fine tuning is being interfered with by U.S. politics. There's no other way to put it. Mm-hmm. And, that's essentially what the impediment has been. I think everybody else, the other five nations that are involved in this are on board.
Hey. You know, your audio just kind of got bad on us. Phil, try jiggling your cord there a little bit.
Yeah, okay. Can you hear me now?
Yeah. No, it's the same. I mean, I can hear you, but the quality is degraded a bit.
Okay, well, I hear you fine. I just,
All right. Well, it'll be all right. It's not too bad. Okay, so, let me ask you this. What to do about it? You, have a great little, write-up in your UNS column about what the American people can do to help try to shift the balance of power here in America on this issue.
Yeah, basically, I'm taking the principle of the BDS movement, the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanction movement, which is a Palestinian cause, and saying we need that here. There are a number of billionaires who are strong supporters of Benjamin Netanyahu and his policies, and have basically created this situation. They've enabled the situation where this resistance to policy by the White House is being mounted. And I said, let's identify them and let's do a boycott. And I'm not talking about an organized boycott, but I'm just talking about us as individuals You know, we don't have to go and stay at the Venetian in Las Vegas because that's Sheldon Adelson's hotel. We don't have to go and see a movie where Arnon Milchan is the producer. You know, there are ways that we can take money away from these people and show our dissatisfaction with the policies that they're pushing. Mm-hmm. I think that's a reasonable idea. And I think if it's something that might even catch on among people who are very unhappy about the warfare state that we seem to be involved in.
Yeah. Hey, how about an organized one? All we need is an acronym that rhymes with BDS, but is a little bit different, you know? And then the two go together.
Yeah, we could do that. If you come up with something, tell me.
Yeah. Well, somebody come up with something. I don't know. Give me a minute to think about it when I'm not live on the air, and maybe I'll be able to. But yeah, no, I think that's a great idea, and it's actually... you know, I know that you're a regular reader of Mondo Weiss like myself. You're talking about a handful of guys here, very few, businessmen, who just put their fortune on the side of the Israeli right as much as they possibly can. And they're pretty easy to identify and boycott. I mean, that should be doable. Why not?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I name a number of them in my article. I mean, there's Robert Kraft, the owner of the, New England Patriots. There's also, of course, Adelson. There's Haim Saban. There is Milchan. You know,
Singer.
There,
is it Paul Singer?
Yeah, Singer would be another one, sure. Uh-huh. No question about it.
Yeah.
And I was thinking the Seagram family, the Bronfman family, which owns Seagram in Canada, major supporters of right-wing Israel, but apparently they've sold their business interests, so it wouldn't make any sense to boycott them.
Yeah. All right. Well, yeah, I mean, there's a good list to start right there. And you know what? I was just talking with Annie Robbins from Mondo Weiss the other day about the BDS and the numbers, and what's happening now is it's not just the hurt of the withholding of the money, but it's just the bad PR for being on the wrong side of the line, where now businesses that don't give a damn either way are looking at it purely from a bottom line point of view. The boycott is working, and it's kind of snowball rolling downhill kind of thing, you know?
That's right.
And so it's becoming more and more powerful as it becomes more and more powerful on a parabola sort of a deal is what I'm trying to say. So anyway, great. Yeah, man, great idea. I think we should do it. And great article, Crunch Time with Iran. It's at the Uns Review, uns.com. Thanks, Phil. Appreciate it.
Okay, Scott. Bye-bye.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. All right, guys, welcome back. I'm sorry. I meant to try to figure out a way to bring this up in the draw of the interview because I forgot earlier in the show. And now I'm just going to have to step all over Robert Naiman's interview with it because I just have to mention this because it's so great. Former Bush officials teaching course on Iraq war decision making. Wolfowitz and Libby. Right? Other than Pearl, like those are the two worst ones. And they do admit that, oops, Iran benefited. I don't think they quite say oops. Anyway, that's hilarious. I forgot. Did they say what college? Is it going to be at Harvard or something? How we did pretty good, it's going to be called. Anyway, hilarious. On the line, I got Robert Naiman. I assume he thinks that's hilarious, too. He's from Just Foreign Policy. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Robert?
Good to be with you.
Oh, now you sound terrible again. What happened?
You made me take away my headphones. That means I can't put my mouth at the mouthpiece.
Oh, well, when you unplugged your headphones, after that it sounded great, but now it sounds bad again.
How's this?
Good enough, I guess. I don't know what happened.
Okay.
All right, I'm sorry. Listen, you got an article here at Common Dreams, and it's in the Viewpoint section today at antiwar.com for everyone to go and look at. It's in the highlights at the top of the page. Freedom Flotilla 3, exposes the anti-democratic extremism of the Israeli center. And we can get to that. We got plenty of time. But first of all, what's a Freedom Flotilla?
The Freedom Flotilla is an international project of a group of peace and human rights advocates from around the world, particularly Europe, who've been sailing towards Gaza to protest the Israeli-led blockade of Gaza and the fact that people in Gaza aren't allowed to use their seaports, they're not allowed to export, they're not allowed to have normal travel and commerce. And this has been going on for several years. The latest iteration happening has just been happening this week, Freedom Flotilla 3.
All right. And so what's the news?
Well, the news is that the flotilla was stopped. What I wrote about in my piece was, you know, what was illustrated in terms of the reaction of the official Israeli political sector. One of the participants in the flotilla was Bahar Gattas, who's a member of the Israeli parliament. Other participants included a Spanish member of the European Parliament, the former president of Tunisia, other parliamentarians. The rhetoric coming out of the Israeli government, the official Israeli government circles, was hysterical. I pointed out an example in my piece. This guy, Yair Lapid, former Israeli finance minister, leader of the Yesh Atid party, who's routinely described in U.S. press as centrist, and his political party is described as centrist. He said the participants in this flotilla, he's quoted in the Jerusalem Post, saying these people are nothing but a gang of terror supporters whom Israel should deal with as it would deal with trying to disperse a violent protest. This, I think, exposes the character of these people who would like to be perceived, in particularly in the West, as, you know, we're just Europeans, you know, we're a democracy like you, when their occupation of the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem is challenged by a nonviolent protest. They get hysterical, and they try to crush that protest and that opposition by any means that they can. And I think this is important for people in the West who are either supporting or passive about these policies to understand what it is that the United States government is supporting in terms of Israeli policies.
Yeah. Now it's funny because when what you say about them being so hysterical, like the panic in it. I remember back in 2010 when the Mavi Marmara was seized and the Israeli reaction going on, and Max Blumenthal was there, I guess, doing the research for his book Goliath at the time, and he filmed a big rally. And, you know, I'm pretty sure he had the permission of the parents to film this five-year-old boy explaining what was going on here. And it was all about, you know, the IDF heroes protecting the Israelis from invasion, and the way the five-year-old explains it, they were coming to invade with sticks to kill us all and throw us all in the ocean and make, you know, and but our heroes defeated them and this kind of thing. And it was perfect because you would absolutely have to be 5 years old to believe that this is what's going on. And yet the entire crowd, that's their narrative. That's where he got it from. And that's what they're saying is like, oh my God, a gigantic terrorist flotilla of Hezbollah and Al-Qaeda stick wheeling madmen came to kill us for being Jewish. And that's basically the best they got. It's, they have to stick with that, you know, just stay scared because we cannot have a reasonable discussion about what might be the problem here because they'll lose it because what they're doing is wrong.
And, you know, we should always remind ourselves that this dynamic is not limited to Israel. It also includes, importantly for us, the supporters of the Israeli government in the United States, supporters of the Netanyahu government in the United States. We just saw an example, you know, the fast-track bill that just passed Congress had language inserted by Maryland Senator Ben Cardin at the behest of the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee that says it has to be a U.S. negotiating objective in its trade negotiations with Europe. The U.S. must impose Israeli trade sanctions. It must oppose Israeli, European, I'm sorry, U.S. must oppose in its negotiations with Europe European trade sanctions against trade with illegal Israeli settlements in the West Bank. They lie about this. It's kind of a similar dynamic. They say, oh, my God, you know, these horrible global BDS people are against Israel, hate Israel, and are trying to boycott Israel. But you actually read the text of the bill. What it's about is Israeli settlements in the West Bank. And so what they're doing is saying Israel equals Israeli settlements in the West Bank. If you're right. against Israeli settlements in the West Bank, you're against Israel. That's in the text of their bill. So it's really a similar dynamic. It's exactly the same. You know, we refuse to discuss what we're actually doing, the actual policies that we're implementing, why we're doing that. So we just have to throw up this scare flag. Everybody's against us because they're, you know, the world hates us, we're anti-Semites. Anybody who criticizes us, that's because they're anti-Semites who hate the Jews, and so on and so forth. They have to do the hysteria because they're afraid of a rational discussion about the real things that are actually happening. And unfortunately, you know, we laugh, and it is laughable, and yet we're talking about something that far from being marginal. I mean, this is Congress just approved it. Ben Cardin, you know, who would like people to think that he's a liberal internationalist, brought this to the bill and insisted that there could be no change to the text. You know, AIPAC will not permit us to change this text a little bit before putting this in our bill. So that's exactly what is going on, and that's why it's so important to educate, engage, alert the American people that this is what's being done. This isn't just about Israel over there. Our government, our tax dollars, our power is being, our national power is being used to support these policies. And there is an increasing movement of resistance of this around the world, including the United States.
I'm sorry, Robert, I got to stop you here. Let's take this break. We'll be right back, everybody, with Robert Nayman from Just Foreign Policy, and this one is at Common Dreams and Antiwar.com today. We'll be right back.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America Lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, guys, welcome back to the show. I'm talking with Robert Nayman about the attempt of some very professional and legitimate and elected people to float some boats and break the Gaza blockade, and how they've been denounced as the terrorist scum of the earth by the Israeli center, not even the right-wing extremists, but the reasonable ones over there, and how the reason why is because the truth is what's going on in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, well, gee, it's just unfair. And if we had a frank discussion about it, things would have to change. And so instead, it's apparently, at least in the past, has proven to be more effective to just scream, you know, everybody in the world is an anti-Semite and they're against us just for being us, rather than admitting, which it seems kind of silly. It's not like anybody in Israel doesn't know that they're occupying the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, right? It's a pretty big elephant in the room there to try to ignore. But anyway, that's where the discussion is stuck. And that's why these guys are getting on these boats, men and women. Are getting on these boats and trying to break the blockade and just to bring some humanitarian supplies and a little bit of light to the situation. Robert, right?
Yes. And are shedding light, I think, in the sense that, I mean, the, you know, the, unfortunately, the normal state of affairs is that there's almost no Western press coverage of Gaza, for example. But right now, there is in significant measure because the flotilla is happening. So it's an indication that this is something that group of people in the West care about, and the Western media should pay attention to it.
Yeah, definitely. Well, so now, how many times have you ever been to the Gaza Strip? You've been there before, right?
I have been twice, many years ago. But since then, I've participated in many Gaza-aimed efforts in which I didn't actually reach Gaza. So, for example, I was part of the 2011 flotilla where we weren't allowed to leave Greece, and I was part of the Gaza Freedom March where we tried to go from Cairo and were blocked. Mm-hmm. So I both had the experience of actually being there and also the experience of being prevented from going.
All right. Well, so assuming we've got the attention of some people who just don't know anything about it except the name of it, because you just told them it's called Gaza, what's the big deal anyway?
Well, the big deal is that, first of all, if there is any diplomatic resolution of the conflict, that means the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza being an independent Palestinian state. And that is what the Israeli government and its supporters are trying to prevent. Also, you have 1.8 million human beings living in intolerable condition of not having a normal life, where they can't travel to study, they can't export, they can't import normally, they can't travel for medical care normally, they can't travel to be with family normally. And these policies could not stand if it were not for the cooperation of the United States government in these policies. And that's why it's so crucial, first of all, for Americans to know that this is happening, and secondly, to support efforts to challenge these policies that are causing completely unnecessary human suffering just to serve the political agenda of people that are trying to make the occupation permanent.
Mm-hmm. And now, I'm sure you come across this all the time. I think it's, you know, it certainly, wouldn't say I was raised by this by my family, but I think just TV, we just hear maybe characters on TV shows say this from time to time, whatever. It's just kind of the common theme in America is that, well, you know, over there in the Middle East, they've been fighting for thousands of years over that kind of thing, and it's all just a big unresolvable religious mess, which warrants my inattention because nobody's right or they're both right or some kind of problem, and so who cares about it? What's wrong with that point of view?
Well,
or what's right about it?
I'm not sure I understood the question.
Well, just, you know, many Americans just kind of think of the whole thing as an intractable religious kind of war. Maybe they assume more or less equal sides in it and that it's all kind of just unresolvable. And so they don't really pay much attention to it or want to know the details of it or anything like that. Do you not agree with that? I mean, obviously,
yeah.
you do the work, but so what's wrong with that argument that, come on, man, this has been going on for thousands of years, right? That's what they say.
Well, first of all, the first thing that Americans have to understand is that this is not some over there thing. You know, some people in the U.S. would say, oh, that's a big mess, kind of like Ukraine. We shouldn't get involved. The problem is we are involved. We're involved, you know, up to our eyeballs. The U.S. government is involved. And if you pay taxes in the United States, you're involved because the U.S. government is involved. The U.S. government gives $5 billion in military aid to Israel every year. But perhaps even more importantly, the United States government provides diplomatic and political cover to the Israeli government by vetoing resolutions at the U.N. Security Council by opposing international diplomatic efforts to resolve the conflict. So we are involved. If you personally, you know, close your eyes and close your ears, that doesn't mean that you're not involved because the our power to support these policies. This conflict has not been going on for thousands of years. It's been going on since the late 19th century, when the modern political Zionism, which was an innovation in world Jewish affairs at the time, decided to colonize Palestine. The creation of Israel was in 1948. The occupation of the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem started in 1967. So these are not ancient problems. And while there's no dispute that, you know, Jews have a different religion than Muslims, and of course not all Palestinians are Muslims, some Palestinians are Christians, this is not a dispute about religious belief. This is a dispute about territory and about the freedom of the people who live on the territory. And when the Israeli army withdraws from the West Bank, this conflict is over. And this is what the fight is about. It's about the presence of Israeli soldiers in the West Bank and the presence of Israeli settlers in the West Bank, who are the excuse for the presence of the Israeli soldiers. When they leave, this conflict ends.
Mm. Now, a year ago, didn't the Israelis agree to lift the siege in some specific areas as terms of the ceasefire when they finally ended the slaughter?
That agreement was never fully implemented. Since the blockade was first imposed, it has varied. I mentioned before how the blockade was eased when the Morsi government was elected in Egypt and then intensified when that government was overthrown in a military coup. The blockade was also eased after the Israeli attack on the Mavi Marmara brought greater international pressure to bear, including U.S. pressure on the blockade. But it's never been lifted, and whenever it's eased, it's still at the whim of the Israeli and Egyptian authorities. You know, it'll be announced like, okay, now they're opening the Rafah crossing and people can go out. Then later they close it again. So this is an unsustainable situation. It's a violation of the human rights of 1.8 million people not to have the normal expectation that they can participate in travel and commerce, education, get medical care like anybody else in the world would expect to be able to do.
Mm. Yeah, again, and I'm sorry to even kind of bother you with that, but I mean, it's a ridiculous trope. That's how I even described it in my note to remind me to say that or to ask you about that. It is kind of a ridiculous thing, but I think it's pretty much what passes for conventional wisdom over there. And then, of course, your answer is perfectly right that this isn't thousands of years old. This is going on right now. And you can, you know, count the series of major events that have led us to this over the past few decades. And as you said, the solutions are right in front of us, too, mostly for the Israelis to stop doing what they're doing to these poor people. Simple as that. Anyway, I just like the way you say it, man. I think it appeals to people because you're obviously so fair and honest about it and just saying the way it is and in a way that, you know, gets across well. So thanks very much for coming back on the show, Robert.
Good to be with you.
Appreciate it. And that's it for the show. Thanks, everybody.